I work with Greenville Rescue Mission. I'm a counselor at the men's shelter downtown. It's my day job. And one of the special areas that I work in is in the area of addiction. So people who are trying to come out of addiction or need to be trying to come out of addiction or want to come out of addiction, I tend to work with those folks, and that's part of my own story as well. And one of the guys that came in, he came in about 5.5 months ago, and I'll call him Fred, and I've really gotten to know this guy and love him a lot. He had been in and out of prison over the years, but he had mostly been in drug abuse for more than 30 years. And he came to the mission kind of desperate, which is actually a good way to come. And he ended up being one of my guys, and he began to change dramatically very early. And one of the most dramatic ways, maybe the most dramatic way, is he quit worshiping himself, and he started following Christ. And he really was a different person. It was obvious. But there were other things that were changing. He has the most clean time he's had in more than 30 years, 5.5 months, which is a big deal for 30 years. And when he quit poisoning himself with drugs and alcohol, he realized that he had a brain underneath all that. And so he's only the second guy that I've had there that's gotten his GED while he's been there. And next month, he's going to start going to Greenville Tech. Just a really encouraging guy, and I consider him a friend. I'm privileged to know him. He was sitting on my couch this week, and this is true of a lot of people who have wasted a lot of their lives. He was saying, you know, he wants to get his stuff back. He wants to get a life because he's wasted so much of it. But he said this: I have trouble being patient, but I keep reminding myself how trustworthy God has been. I have trouble being patient, but I keep reminding myself how trustworthy God has been. And I thought, who's counseling whom? In that moment, he was my mentor. He was doing what this psalm is inviting, even commanding us to do when we're impatient, to remind ourselves how trustworthy God has been in the midst of the anxieties of life, learning to rest in God. He says in verse 1, "For God alone my soul waits in silence, and from him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my mighty fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken." So, is that real? Like, can we really get to a place where we're waiting patiently for God to move? Or is this just one of those, like, things they say at church that sounds good in theory, but it doesn't really work in real life? Because what he's talking about here is a little child wailing who gets picked up by her mother and she begins to rest. A baby falls asleep on her mother's chest. But is that real? How do you get there? Can you get there? Or is this just for like Christian Jedis, right? They got the special something or other that only they have, like David had it, but I'm just a normal sort of person. I can't get to that place. Well, he does. Show us how we can get there. Four things that we're going to look at is he shows us how attacks can get us there, how practice can get us there, how temptations can get us there, and how resting in the character of God can get us to a place of peace through attacks, practice, temptations, and the character of God. So let's take a look at the attacks first. And they start right off. He goes from verses 1 and 2 being at rest. And then immediately in verse 3, we read this: "How long will all of you attack a man to batter him?" And that word that's translated batter really is better translated: how long will you attack a man to murder him? There are literally people in David's life, and if you know anything about his life, who are trying to murder him, and they were doing it for a long time. Early on, he gets brought into Saul's house, and he's minding his own business, playing the harp one day, and a spear comes at him, thrown by Saul, who hates him, and he wants to murder him. And then David kills Goliath, and boy, it's game on at that point, because he's bringing his whole army after David. God does away with Saul, and David becomes king. But because of his own sin, because of his own choices, he brings chaos into his family, and his advisors are saying, yes, David, we love you, and they're plotting behind his back. And even his son goes to war against him. This is real. And David is saying that I feel like a leaning wall, a tottering fence, like a Jenga tower, you know? Just breathe on it, and that's me. I'm going to fall. And they're making plans. Look at verse 4. They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. Think about that. Who has not experienced that? They bless with their mouths, but inwardly there's a dagger just waiting, right? If it sounds like middle school. At least the middle school I went to. Or high school, or most workplaces, right? Who has not worked in a workplace where there's politics? Where there's whispering, there's planning, there's plotting going on. And it doesn't really matter if someone's trying to murder you or not. The point is this: anything that makes you feel like you're going to fall over, anything that feels just a little too overwhelming, just another diaper that I have to change today, another toddler I have to chase, I'm single and I want to be married. I'm married and I want to be single. I have pain. I got a bad report from the doctor. I have emotional pain. I have my sin. And it feels overwhelming. I have their sin and it feels overwhelming. And here's where we have an opportunity. Because every single row in this room has multiple people in it dealing with multiple things that feel overwhelming. You came in here with them. Sometimes we're aware of them, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're right there in front of us, and sometimes it's just the dull ache. But we all have them. And the opportunity comes here because few things have the potential to focus our soul and our mind and our energy like difficulties. And if you haven't experienced that yet, you just haven't lived long enough. Few things have the potential to focus us like difficulties. And it's amazing that David, who's probably a king at this point, doesn't start tweeting out things, right? He doesn't get his PR department to go spin anything. David, who's the king and has power, says, I'm going to do one thing. I'm going to go to my fortress. Of all the places I could go, I'm going to run into the fortress. I had a friend many years ago. He was a gentle giant, and he was a gentle giant because he had lived a very, very, very hard life. From the day he could walk, he had terrible things in his family. And he would say this, he said, the things in our lives can do one of two things. They can make us more bitter or more beautiful. They can make us more humble or they can make us more hardened. Which do you choose? And so one person comes up against a difficulty in their life and they walk through it as painful as it is. They deal with the temptations. Sometimes they fail, but they walk. And God turns them into a kind person, a humble person, a compassionate person. And someone else faces very much the same thing and they turn into a hard person, a cynical person, a hopeless person. Same situation, different results, different fortress. Where do you look for hope? Because you're attacked. We sang about it earlier, right? You say, I don't have anybody who's murdering me. Well, yes, you do, right? That ancient foe who seeks to work us woe. His craft and his power are great and armed with cruel hate. On earth is not his equal. There is only one word that will fail him. That word is Christ. And you have an enemy. You don't see him. You don't smell him. But he stayed up all night thinking of ways to screw up your life. Where are you going to run? You don't even know he's out there, do you? We believe in things we can't see. We believe some of those things hate us and they want to murder us. So this king runs into the fortress, but he doesn't just do it once. It's not just the attacks. It's what he does with the attacks. And look what he says, the contrast in verse 1. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. Now jump down to verse 5. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from him. See, what he's saying in verse 1 is, this is the place I've gotten to. How did I get there? I practice. I say to my soul, soul, trust in God. Soul, run to him. And what's being talked about here is something that psychologists have labeled self-talk. Right? It's been around for a long time. It just got a label fairly recently. It's what we say to ourselves that we're not even aware we're saying them. Like, I know a bunch of y'all out there, you've thoughts are going 100 miles an hour at all times in your head. Noisy minds. Noisy souls. And we don't even realize that we're doing this. But I actually think it's not self-talk. I think it's self-listen. And that's dangerous because we lie to ourselves and we believe crazy stuff sometimes. And David is saying to his soul, no, no, I will not listen to you. You will listen to me. And we will go to the fortress and we will go to our only hope. Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was a pastor in the last century, commented on this phenomenon of talking to yourself. He says, have you realized that most of your unhappiness in life is due to the fact that you are listening to yourself instead of talking to yourself? Take those thoughts that come to you the moment you wake up in the morning. You've not originated them, but they start talking to you. They bring back the problems of yesterday or the fears about tomorrow. Somebody's talking. Who is talking? Yourself is talking to you. Now, this man's treatment in the psalm was this. Instead of allowing his self to talk to him, he starts talking to himself. The main art or skill I might use in the matter of spiritual living is to know how to handle yourself. You have to take yourself in hand. You have to address yourself, preach to yourself, question yourself. It has to be active. Because passively, if we just do nothing, we know where that's going to end up. You fall asleep on the raft and you drift and drift and drift and you wake up sunburned and you're 3 miles from land and you go, how did I get out here? Well, you just did nothing. And the soul drifts, does it not? So I said I worked with addicts mostly, and one of the things I say to them is that we addicts are amazing forgetters. We are really excellent at forgetting. And guess what? You don't have to be an addict to be really good at it. He reminds himself of who God is. And so he says in verse 6, look at it. He only is my rock and my salvation and my fortress. And then he says, come to think on it, I won't be shaken. Verse 2, I'll be greatly shaken, or I won't be greatly shaken. No, I'm not going to be shaken at all because I have a rock and I have a fortress and I have a salvation. And these words are big words. They're rich in any language. Rock, fortress, refuge. But they had special meaning to the Israelites. If you were Hebrew and you were hearing this, yeah, you would hear rock. But your mind, your collective mind would be taken back to these episodes in Israel's history where rock shows up. For example, when the children of Israel come out of Egypt and they're in, a million of them or more, in the desert, needing some water. And they start complaining. And God sends Moses to strike a rock. And water comes out. Or when Moses wanted to see God, see the glory of God, and God said, you can't see my glory and live. Who do you think you are? But I'll put you in a cleft in a rock, and my hand will cover you, and I'll pass by, and you'll see the back of me. And Moses was never the same. And so this rock imagery was deeply embedded into the people of Israel. And that word salvation that is mentioned several times, that too was part of their history. That particular word, believe it or not, it's not used a lot in the Old Testament. One of the places it is used is, again, when the children of Israel are coming out of Egypt and they're, you know, woo, we're free, we're not slaves anymore, let's party. And they're having a party by the Red Sea, right? Yeah, we're not slaves. And then in the middle of the party, they hear chariots, the rumble of horses and chariots coming after them. And all of a sudden, they go from celebrating to flipping out. Because there they are between the Red Sea and the most powerful army on the planet. And they flip out, which is what we usually do when we're between a rock and a hard place. Ah! God has abandoned me! And that's what they did to Moses. In Exodus 14, they said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that if you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. Like, how bad is their memory? You talk about some self-talk, right? It was great in Egypt. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, fear not, stand firm, see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. And Moses is saying to the people what David is saying to his soul and what God is saying to us today, and that is quit believing the lies that you don't even know that you believe and start believing the truth and personalize it. Here's one of the common things, like, God loves that person, God loves that person, and God cares about them, but God doesn't care about me. And that may be how you feel, but that don't make it true. My rock, my salvation, rich. And so we have to actually do something. To actually do something. What do we have to do? I'd been kind of chewing on this psalm for a while, and a couple of weeks, it was about 10 days ago, my wife and I were having a discussion, shall we say, before work one day, and back in the old days, our discussions were not pretty. We've gotten much better over the years, but I still have a few opinions, and so does she, and they're not always the same opinion. And so we were having a discussion before work, and I was kind of worked up. You know that feeling? That worked up feeling? Maybe you look calm on the outside, but you're worked up on the inside. And so I have to go to work, and so I go jump into the car, and my car, the car that I usually drive, always has the radio on. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just being honest with you, okay? Always has the radio on. But I jump into my daughter's car, and her stereo only talks to her phone, and I obviously didn't have her phone, so I had to sit in that car silent. Silent is uncomfortable for loud, noisy Americans. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll practice what I'm going to preach. And I begin to rehearse with my own soul. I begin to tell my soul, you only have one fortress. You only have one rock. And it's not your wife. As wonderful as she is, she ain't your rock. She can never be that for you. And I began to rehearse the truth that God has given me. So, and was it magic? Like, did I suddenly go, hey, I'm great? No. But I did feel my anxiety level. I'm okay. I'm not going to be shaken. I'm okay here in this fortress. I'm not shaken. And so what if? What if we actually did this like crazy? What if we actually read God's word, heard what it said, and then actually put it into practice? What if instead of the next time you're bored or lonely, instead of sending another snap or another text or following this story or starting your own story or following that whatever thing, what if instead of reaching for that, you said, I think I'll talk to the Lord? Because I'm feeling lonely right now, and I'm kind of bored. Sarah prayed it earlier. Proverbs 18:10 says, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. And what he's saying is not God's name. In that culture, your name was your character. The character of God is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. Do you realize that oftentimes when we pick up that phone, we're actually running from God? We're running from intimacy. We're running from a fortress. What if instead of running from God and hiding from God, we ran to him? Because the doors are open. That's what he says. So, in order for that to happen, there are some things we have to reject. There are some things that clamor for our attention, that clamor for our trust. There are temptations that we have. And two of the main ones are status and money, and he mentions both of those. They're substitute fortresses. In verse 9, he mentions status. Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion or are a lie. In the balances, they go up because they're lighter than air. They're lighter than a breath. And what he's saying is this. One of the places that we're tempted to find our self, our worth, is in status. Or to put it differently, what people think of me. Is this not what makes middle school so difficult? What do they think of me? How do I get them to like me? I said in the first service, nothing really changes the older you get. By the way, the middle schoolers just get older, right? Still struggling with the same thing. You know, what do they think of me? David Letterman, who was a longtime late night host, funny, very talented, very successful, made a lot of money. They asked him what drove him, what motivated him. And here's what he said. Every night, you're trying to prove your self-worth. It's like meeting your girlfriend's family for the first time. You want to be the absolute best, wittiest, smartest, most charming, best-smelling version of yourself. If I can make people enjoy the experience and have a higher regard for me when I'm finished, it makes me feel like an entire person. If I've come short of that, I'm not happy. How things go for me every night is how I feel about myself the next 24 hours. And you go, well, that's kind of sick. Until you go, wait, that's what I do with my job. I look for self-worth in my job, in my status, in my looks, in my whatever. Whatever that isn't the rock. Do you even know the places that your soul tends to go instead of going to God? Do you have any self-awareness about that? And I tell people, because addiction is part of my story, of all the things I've been addicted to, at the top of the list was what other people thought of me. Some of y'all aren't as sick as I am. Some of you are. And wealth, verse 10, put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery, legal or illegal ways of getting money. If riches increase, what a beautiful word, set not your heart on them. If you invested in Bitcoin when it was at 500 and now you're a multi-gazillionaire, don't set your heart on Bitcoin because it can go away like that. Some of you are like, what is Bitcoin? Don't worry about it. Because you can't afford it anyway now, right? What do I trust? Well, I trust my insurance. I trust my retirement. I trust my ability to gain money and to keep it. But David, who had money and who had status, said, you can't trust that. You can't fall in love with something. Don't set your heart on something that can't love you back and can disappear like that. Instead, he uses this word only. And he repeats it over and over. It doesn't come through in the English. If we were reading this in Hebrew, it would jump off the page because six times he starts verses with the word only. And I'll just highlight four of them. Verse one, in the Hebrew it reads this, only for God my soul waits in silence. Verse two, only he is my rock and my salvation. Verse five, only for God, O my soul, wait in silence. Verse 6, only he is my rock and my salvation. And so David is saying, of all the things I could trust or you could trust, there has to be a narrowing of our focus to only God. All other ground, sinking sand. Do you actually believe that? Or is that just a nice thing we say at church? Do you actually believe that there's only one place that will not fail you, that will not abandon you, that will not turn its back on you, that will welcome you despite all of your sin? And David had plenty. And when my addiction brought me to the place where I had burned every bridge, every one of them, they were all burned. And I was living in the Greenville Rescue Mission instead of working in the Greenville Rescue Mission, and I was literally alone. Like there was nobody I could call. Well, I could call them, but if they were smart, they wouldn't take my call because I was off the rails. I was alone. Except I wasn't. I was talking to God, walking up and down the halls of the Greenville Rescue Mission and just lamenting, feeling sorry for myself, if I'm really honest. Oh, I'm alone. God's like, no, finally got you where you can pay attention to me. Finally got you where you're not trusting everything else, including yourself. Because self-trust is the most desperately abandoning trust we can have. And so we come to these places in life, and let me say this to you. If God has gifted you with a place in your life where you are empty-handed and he is all that you got, that is the greatest gift he could ever give you. Because you will find out in that place, like you will find out in no other place, that he's all you ever had to begin with. And he's all you'll ever have. And that's way more than you need. Do you believe this? So he comes back to the character of God. See, it would be wrong if we would start looking at ourselves, well, I got to do this, I got to do this. No, that's not where he goes. He goes to the character of God. And he camps out. He ends there. Look at verse 11. He says, once God has spoken, twice have I heard this, that power belongs to God. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. he comes back. What do you think of God? And here's a better question. Is what you think about God who God really is? Or do you have an image of God that he isn't really? David brings us to two poles, the power of God and the steadfast love of God. Think about that for a second, the power of God, the power that brought the Israelites out of Egypt, the most powerful country on the planet, and God brought them out. The power that said, light be. Actually didn't even say it, just thought it. There it is. A universe that's expanding, but it's held in his hands, power. What if you have power but not love? Some of y'all grew up in a family like that. There's power but not love. What if you have love but no power? It's like cotton candy, right? God brings these two things together. And it's not just love that he talks about. The word that's used there in the Hebrew is the word chesed. Say that 10 times. And you may be very familiar with that word. I know we've talked about it at times. But it's not just love, kind of like love, generic love. It's a special kind of love that God has for his people. It's a covenantal love. It's his marriage love. It's the love that says this, for better or worse, sickness and in health, richer or poorer, and even death won't separate us. And I'm the only one who can keep that vow. And he does. These two things that he brings together, and they're brought together in our lives. So here's the thing. If you are his, and you may not be, but if you are, he has steadfast love for you, and it doesn't really matter how you feel. You might say, I don't feel loved. Well, it doesn't really change the fact that you are. But that's for you. And he has power for you as well. But then there's this last little thing here on the end that seems confusing to me, or it did when I first read it. The very last part of Psalm 62, he says this, for you will render to a man according to his work. And that seems strange to me. Because my first response is what I think probably some of y'all first response is, oh man, we were doing so good. And now I'm gonna be repaid according to my work. And if I'm honest, it's not always good, right? I knew God was like Santa Claus and he's only gonna give presents to the nice people, right? Except even Santa Claus doesn't work that way because y'all got some presents. And I did too. I've been plenty naughty. Now, I think what's being said here is that God is always going to do right. He's always going to do justly. But that doesn't solve the problem either, does it? Because you're like, do I really want justice from God? I mean, really? Do I really want justice from God? Do I really want what I deserve? And I think there's something different going on here. Because think about who's talking. It's David. Yeah, that David. The one who basically took a woman and forced himself on her. And then murdered her husband to cover his tracks. And then 11 Psalms earlier in Psalm 51, he admits it. He comes clean, and he does it before everybody. If there's one person who isn't going to say, I deserve good things, it's David. He says in Psalm 51, that famous psalm, he says this, have mercy on me, O God, according to your chesed, according to your abundant mercy. Blot out my transgressions, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. So here's the question, how can God be just and forgiving? We think it'd be one or the other, right? He can be just or he can be forgiving. And the answer to that question is when God brings power and chesed together in the person of his son. Because that word rock, Remember, big word. Paul picks it up. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says this, "For I do not want you to be aware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." This is in the wilderness wandering. "And all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." Struck so that you could drink. And that word salvation, it's the word Yeshua, which when translated into Greek is the word Jesus, which when translated into English is the word Jesus. Salvation, a rock. How can you be sure, if you are one of his, that you will not be shaken? Because he's already been shaken for you. He's been to hell itself. And his power brought him out, rolled another rock away, and brought him out. So that he is a victor over all sin and all death and hell itself for his people. And he does it because he chesed's you. And so you can be sure that you're not going to tip over, because he's going to hold you. Now that's a refuge. What are you going to do with it? I read something on social media this week that said this: "I keep looking at my phone like I matter to someone." And there were people LOLing it, and people rolling on the floor LOLing it, and other LOLs, other different kinds of LOLs, because this is funny. I keep looking at my phone like I matter to someone, and I'm brokenhearted. What if you looked at a rock and a fortress and a salvation and a Yeshua like you matter to him? What if you went there? And so there's only one real takeaway that the psalmist gives us, and it's in verse 8. He's talked to his soul, he's talked about his enemies, he's talked about the temptation, he's talked about who God is, and then he turns and he looks at us. In verse 8, he says this: "Trust in him at all times, O people." And I think he means it. Like, all times. When you're being tempted to look at that thing you shouldn't look at, or you've already fallen, trust in him at all times. O people, pour out your heart to him, for God is a refuge for us. So he's saying, pour out your heart. And what's interesting is twice he's talked about being silent before God. But now he's saying, pour out your heart. Pour it all out. Pour out your anxieties. Pour out your fears, your doubts. Tell him how much you don't trust him, because he already knows anyway. Pour it all out. Pour out your sins to him. Pour it out. Vomit onto God. And then your soul will be quiet. Did you know that there are 4 psalms of complaint? I think that's awesome. Because it's God saying this: look, I know you're going to complain. That's what you do. Let me show you how to do it. With me in the room. So here are some psalms, and that's how you use the psalms, by the way. The psalms are there when you can't sing and you can't pray, and someone else is going to sing and pray for you. And they're going to teach you how to complain to God with him in the room, because you already do it anyway. And so this pour out your heart is plural. It's pour out y'all's heart, for God is a refuge for us. And see, we make a mistake if we only read this as individualistic. Okay, when I go and I have my quiet time, I can pour out my heart. That's true. But you know, another time, I can't tell you how many Sundays I've come to church and I didn't want to be here. And I didn't want to sing. because I didn't feel like singing, and I was hurting. And y'all were pouring out your heart. For me. And y'all were running to a refuge that I was having trouble just crawling to. This is not individual. This is an us thing. And so that busy mind, that loud soul that we have, those worrying thoughts, pour them all out. And maybe after all that, we'll really learn how to sit and just let God be our refuge. Let me pray for us. Father, these are easy words to read and say and maybe listen to and very difficult to actually put into practice. Father, thank you that we don't have to pretend when we come to you. How could we pretend? We don't have to pull our punches or guard our words. We can pour out our hearts to you. We can vomit onto you and find peace. Because you've already said you're a rock for us, and you went all that way to hell to show it. So Lord, as we leave, teach us to practice the skill of coming to you at all times. Would you start with me, I pray.